Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special broadcast from the Chadwick Arboretum plant sale at The Ohio State University today. If you are interested in joining us, check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides and hurry on down here. The EPA is warning that a toxic blob is threatening Cleveland's water supply. The poisonous sediment dredged from the Cuyahoga River was dumped into Lake Erie before the regulations put in place by the 1972 Clean Water Act. At another end of the lake, Toledoans still remember nearly 3 years ago when an agricultural runoff from the western Lake Erie Basin fed harmful algal blooms that tainted the water supply there. That crisis riveted public attention on how agricultural runoff of fertilizers and manure affects our most precious water. Some farmers have begun to introduce new conservation practices, but change is slow. It takes time to make these changes. Coming up, we'll hear from the Ohio Farm Bureau about what they're doing and what they're working on. Joining us now is Professor William Mitch. He is director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founding director of the Wilma H. Schirmeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park right here at Ohio State University. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start with the news about the dangers to Cleveland's water. Unlike the agricultural runoff, this danger is from industrial waste, right?
Right. And this is the legacy thing that we're having in the older cities up north. In many ways, it's very similar to Flint. In other words, we had an infrastructure in that had lead in the pipes, but nobody cared about it until now. Likewise, it was, in our view now, unconscionable. You'd be dumping the dredge fill out in the middle of Lake Erie, but it was the standard thing to do in the 50s and 60s.
So it wasn't as if when they dredged the sediment and dumped it in Lake Erie, they were thinking, oh, we're going to get rid of this toxic waste. They were just dredging it because of the shipping lanes, right?
Yeah, the word toxic wasn't even around then.
Right.
I mean, it was sediments, and they were just getting rid of it, and probably no thought about the quality of it or anything like that. But you got to remember, it was the Cuyahoga River, and that was a river in those days
river.
Was the burning river. And so it makes sense that, and the burning, by the way, I could go on and on about that. That was basically a mixture of oil from the Rockefeller legacy and trees from the Cuyahoga forest. You get trees, oil, somebody strikes a match, and you got a burning river. That's exactly what it was.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting from the Ohio State University Chadwick Arboretum annual plant sale. We're on the corner of Lane Avenue and Fred Taylor Drive. You can get more information if you go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about water quality issues this hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We said that this was done before the Clean Water Act of 1972. What did that act do that would have prevented this going forward, that prevented this going forward?
Well, actually, the Clean Water Act was, there were water pollution acts even in the 50s,
okay.
But they weren't very effective. So the Clean Water Act had a lot of teeth in it. And actually, that's when the EPA was formed in 1970. So there was a whole new ballgame after about 1970-71 as far as pollution. But even then, we didn't have the Toxic Substance Control Act, which may have been more significant. That wasn't until 1980. So this is just something that's happening around the country, that we find these legacy kind of problems that we had that we didn't know when we were doing it that it was going to be a problem down the line, and it probably will be. You know, I'm not terribly sure it's a gigantic problem yet, but it could be.
Last summer's algal bloom in Lake Erie, up in northwestern Ohio, was the largest on record in Lake Erie. It didn't cause the problems that it had caused the year prior when it came to tainting the drinking water in Toledo and shutting it down for 3 days. What's the chain of events that bring about these blooms, and are we likely to see another one this year?
I think it's going to be an annual event until we get our act together and solve the problem, if we can. But I think the problem is nutrients. Now, that's it's a partial legacy thing, because our soils now have so much nutrients in them from 100 years of use.
Again, the legacy issue.
The legacy, but also it's a here and now. It's the phosphorus that's put on the land in the winter. You'll see it in Lake Erie in the following spring and fall, or spring and summer. So it's a difficult problem to solve. That's the shallowest lake of the Great Lakes. It's the most vulnerable of all the Great Lakes, would be the western basin, Lake Erie. And then you can see the most of it is coming down what they call the Maumee River Basin from Indiana. And it's almost unsolvable in one sense, but in another sense, I think we've got to be bold and look outside of the envelope that we're in now of solving that problem, because it was touted as being an $11 billion a year damage to the economy of the Lake Erie coastline mm-hmm. per year. And if it's $11 billion damage, then that's a lot of funds we can do towards solving the problem, in my view.
People have been farming the Western Lake Erie Basin, which, of course, as you mentioned, includes Indiana, it goes into Indiana for a long time, for 100 or more years. Why is this algal bloom issue kicking up now in recent years?
That's a very good question, because I remember when I first moved to Ohio State in the 1990s, everybody was patting themselves on the back. We solved the phosphorus problem in Lake Erie. Because it was getting cleaner, they took care of what they call the point sources. They took care of the effluents from the cities. They're all on tertiary treatment, which means they take phosphorus out of the water now. And then also a strange thing happened about then. A little organism by the name of the zebra mussel came in. Mm-hmm. And the zebra mussels were the nature's little filter system. People didn't like them because they were invasive species. But my gosh, the next couple of years, I remember going up to Lake Erie, and it looked like Silver Springs in Florida. It was so clean. And it was zebra mussels basically sucking all that upper water through them, taking the algae out, and it was clean. So to be honest, I think the zebra mussels did more than $1 billion of treatment plants. But so now that's run its legacy, if you could call that, or run its course. The zebra mussels are still there, but they're not as... So now we've got in a situation where eventually we have to pay the piper, because we've been continuing to add just too much phosphorus to the Western Basin of Lake Erie.
You know, before we went on the air, you and I were talking. You said that you're now director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park down in Florida. You said you have the same problems down there.
Oh, phosphorus is a gigantic issue down there. So much so that the Everglades Foundation is offering a $10 million prize if you can solve the problem. And we're in the running for that.
And but is it the same problem, the runoff?
Yes, it's coming from the Lake Okeechobee, which is the big lake in there that's fairly well polluted. And then there's some agriculture runoff between there and the Everglades that has to be controlled. And they know how to control it. I mean, they have really shown that they can control phosphorus down there very readily. I know you've seen it. It works. And so they just need more of those wetlands in there. And I'll tell you the whole story if you want, if we have time, about what's going on this particular January and February. It's just horrendous what has happened in the season when all the snowbirds are down there.
Yeah.
A massive amount of pollution went the wrong way. And the Army Corps and the district down there are, rather than apologizing, saying, we had to do it, we had to do it. But it really... Now they're starting to pollute parts of Florida that nobody ever thought we'd get pollution in.
What do you mean the pollution went the wrong way?
Okay, well, we had a 100-year rainfall in January. January is supposed to be dry as today. It's supposed to be blue sky, no rain. It's the dry season. We had 12 inches of rain in January this year. And they weren't prepared for it. They should have been. They weren't prepared for it. This lake filled up. It was a dangerous level. They had to do something with the water. If they send it south where it's supposed to go, it would pollute the Everglades, and nobody wants that.
Okay.
Their hands were tied, so they send it east and west to Fort Myers on one side and down the St. Lucie River, wherever that goes, to the east. So they sent the entire upper waters of the Okeechobee, brown water from pollution, from tannins from trees, from all sorts of things, but very, very different color, I'll tell you that for sure, than is the blue coastal waters, especially the Great Lakes. And I could show you a picture now. It would just shock you. So they're talking about millions and billions of gallons going each way out to the ocean instead of going south.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so, and it got down to there, and people in Fort Myers were saying, what's going on here? And there were people landing at Fort Myers who were taking pictures out of their airplane, and it got on YouTube and became viral. Look at this. Everybody says, what is going on? It's an oil spill. What is it? And it's still going on now. It's not like it ended after 3 days. It's been going on for a month and a half or 2 months. And it's basically so different in color than the coastal blue waters that it just looks gross beyond belief. I could show you a picture I have here somewhere, but it's, and whether it's toxic or something, that's a whole other issue. what's in the water, but it is polluted water, and it's got lots of nutrients in it. So people are very worried they're going to have more red tides examples down there. So the coastal people of Florida are angry beyond belief.
How much of these kind of problems is caused by nature? In other words, it's stuff we can't really control. We can only hope to maybe be prepared for.
This isn't nature. Lake Okeechobee.
Well, the 12 inches of rain, though.
Right. But okay. Lake Okeechobee was there for many.
Gotcha. Okay.
Long, long time. It would fill up with water when there was a big rainstorm, and that's usually in the summer, not the winter. But when there was a big rainstorm, lake fill up, and it would flow south. Mm-hmm. It was a north-south highway, water highway. And that's what formed the Everglades. The Greater Everglades was a river of grass that came out of Lake Okeechobee. Well, they've changed all that. They put a big dike there. People live now south of, you know, for whatever reason, they set up a bunch of agricultural communities like Clewiston that are immediately south of the lake. So they needed a gigantic dam. It's when you drive past Lake Okeechobee, you do not see the lake. You see this big 40, 50-foot tall dam waiting to break someday, but this big dam that holds back Lake Okeechobee. And that's why they had to release the water east and west, because they didn't want to have a disaster of flooding people. So it's a long story, but so we've so changed the hydrology down there. They had no recourse but to send it left and right. And as I said, nature didn't send it left and right.
Gotcha.
There were those rivers, but they were usually drier. You know, they were rivers from the local water. They weren't from Okeechobee. So the basic solution down there, and everybody knows it, is they've had conferences after conference on it, and it's basically send the water south. Now, here's the problem. The Kissimmee River now, the upper reaches of Kissimmee River, is Disney World. And all the urban expansion of Disney World. So there's more runoff coming from there. Then there's a lot of agriculture and farming and ranching and so on as you go down the Kissimmee River, which, by the way, they're fixing, restoring it. And it's absolutely incredible what they're doing there. I'm a big fan of this project, but it cost $1 billion to fix it, to put the kinks back in the river after they straightened it in the 1960s. $1 billion. And that's chump change compared to what they're spending on the Everglades.
You know, they did this in the 1960s when they straightened the river. Didn't they know then what the value was of how the rivers formed and how they should be
apparently
left?
No. And if they did, it was a few isolated scientists that didn't have any impact on the Army Corps. They wanted to straighten it out to get the water out, to drain the land. I mean, it's basically where we always are. Our Western civilization has always been in the idea, let's get the water off the land, it's bad. Whereas the Eastern culture that we now see when we go to China and places like that, they didn't have the wherewithal to do that. And so they were happy to keep the water. And that's why when you go to China, it's all about rice and fish, because the rice paddies and the fish ponds were a very typical part of the culture.
Uh-huh.
Very different philosophies. And we got to get a little bit of that philosophy of keeping the water on our land, because it's valuable.
You're listening to Professor Bill Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founding director of the Wilma H. Shearmeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park right here at Ohio State University. We are broadcasting from the Ohio State University Chadwick Arboretum annual plant sale right here on the corner of Lane Avenue and Fred Taylor Drive. For more information about the plant sale, it goes on through most of the weekend. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. We're going to continue our discussion about water and how to save our most precious resource, water, not just here, around the world. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special broadcast from the Ohio State University Chadwick Arboretum plant sale on the OSU campus. The sale goes on today and tomorrow. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking today about Ohio's most precious natural resource, water. Toxic algae blooms linked to fertilizers, livestock manure, and sewage treatment plants continue to be a problem, especially in Lake Erie. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced it would double funding for a program to reduce farm runoff in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. Still with us is Bill Mitch. He's the director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder of the Wilma H. Schirmeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park right here at Ohio State. Bill, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
And joining us now is Vice President of Public Policy at the Ohio Farm Bureau, Adam Sharp. Welcome back to the show, Adam.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Adam, the Ohio Farm Bureau has chosen three farms south of Toledo to showcase new practices designed to reduce nutrient runoff. Can you tell us more about this program and what your goals are?
Yeah, we're excited. We've been actually talking about this across the country. It's very unique. We're the second set of demonstration farms, is what we call it. It's a watershed demonstration farms project in partnership between Ohio Farm Bureau and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is part of USDA. And this is only the second one in the country. The other one's in Wisconsin. What we're doing is we have three family farms, the Kellogg's, the Kurtz, and the Statlers. They volunteered to allow their farms to demonstrate a whole series of conservation practices and new technologies for farmers to come out and listen and learn and kick the tires, if you will, and learn about these new practices. Farmers are constantly learning and constantly adjusting our practices, they're fascinated by new technologies. They're fascinated by new procedures, new practices that we can put in place in our fields. So this is a very unique project. It's a $1 million project. We're partnering with Ohio State University and others who are very interested. The Nature Conservancy is part of this. So there's a number of groups who are wanting to be part and demonstrate various technologies and practices at the farms. We just launched it a couple weeks ago. So it is a brand new project. It's going to run at least 5 years. And our goal is to bring farmers from all over Ohio, but also farmers probably from Michigan and Indiana as well. They're already talking about their interest in coming to visit this farm.
You said there are three family farms. We know family farms can vary a lot in size. Yes. and in what they do. So what is a typical family farm nowadays? It's a lot bigger than we might think.
Well, actually, that's a great question, because these three farms were selected because of their variety.
Okay.
In size and in also the type of operation that they are. So one of these family farms is only a couple hundred acres, and it is a father and a son, and a couple hundred acres of crops. Another one of the farms is 3,000 acres, and again, it's a father, a grandfather, and three sons, or several sons, who are then operating that farm. Another one is a livestock operation, okay. A livestock farm, where they're raising hogs, and again, a father-son combination with a hog farm. And they're farming a couple hundred acres also, several hundred acres of land, but they also have a larger farm operation that's focused around pork production. So part of the question here that we get from a lot of farmers is it scalable, right? So I might be a very small farmer with only a few hundred acres or maybe even 10 acres, and then I might be one who has 5,000 acres, and I want to understand what practices I can put in place or what technologies can I invest in that might help the different scale of my farm.
Because the economies of scale are very important in farming,
yes,
right?
Very important.
There's not much when you're a small farmer.
Yeah, that's the thing right now. You folks try to lump together, what is agriculture? What's a family farm or what's a larger farm? And family farms are all sizes and all shapes and sizes. Fruits and vegetables, livestock, row crops. So we are dealing with a lot of different types of variety, even in the Western Lake Erie Basin of Ohio. So Northwest Ohio, it's flat. We typically associate with row crop, but there's an enormous amount of variety of agriculture that happens in the Western Lake Erie Basin, including specialty crops is very big, and tomato production and other vegetables. So we are looking at what practices will be helpful to farmers across that basin to put in place. And demonstrating those out on the fields and having the farmers come out and see those practices is a very important way to do that.
You know, Bill Mitch, is there anything about the Maumee River? We were talking about the Kissimmee River in Florida.
Right.
It was straightened out. Now they're trying to let it go back to its natural, as much as possible, trajectory or whatever you want to call it. But is there anything about the Maumee River that is part of this equation?
Oh, there's an absolute similarity in the sense that and I don't know how realistic it will be to happen, but that whole area that is draining phosphorus now, a good portion of the phosphorus going in the Western Lake Erie comes from what used to be called the Black Swamp.
Right.
And it was basically a big forest. A swamp is a forested wetland. It was a big forested wetland from Maumee south, sort of all the way to Fort Wayne, Indiana, actually. And it was basically a barrier between Michigan and Ohio. Now, there are a lot of people that say, I have a joke to tell, just like Trump wants to build a wall around next Florida, I was saying we could get Michigan to build the swamp back and charge them to do it. There's a joke there for peach people.
Appreciate I chuckled.
No, I mean, that would be the equivalent if we could somehow restore. And I'm a realist. I know we're not going to restore all of it, but restore a good portion of that to wetlands. And there is actually a compatible way of building wetlands and having them and recycling the nutrients that you capture with the wetlands back into farming. It could be a closed cycle, in other words. We've got a project that we want to test out up here in Ohio that we're doing down in Florida. So it's very real that we can have our cake and eat it too, but I think we've got to think about the model of that landscape, because it's so flat, is not to drain water out of it, to let the water sit still, be in a wetland, have the wildlife, and also be able to take the nutrients out. That's what wetlands do. That's the best thing that they are good for.
So in terms of what Bill Mitch was just telling us, tell us about some of the projects going on at these three farms, Adam.
Yeah, when you're talking about the Maumee River Basin, it's a heavy agricultural area, absolutely. And really, the Great Lakes, especially Lake Erie, we're talking about one of the world's most rich freshwater sources, and we're also talking about that northern part of Ohio, but across the Great Lakes area, also being one of our country and one of the world's most rich food production areas.
Right.
So Bill mentions having our cake and eating it too. And, we do have to figure out the way to both have our fresh water and also food production. And the two can coexist. And I think the two can coexist very well. And there's a lot of terrific work going on to do that. When you're talking about nutrients in that area, in the Western Lake Erie Basin, the Army Corps data shows about 40% of that nutrients coming down the Detroit River. So that's nutrient we have to deal with in another realm, right, as it comes into the lake from the north.
Right.
About 40% comes down the Maumee, and about 30% is out there already. It's that legacy we talked about earlier of nutrient. So we have to, and the lake does need nutrient, right? So it's rich for a reason with fish and fishing industry. It's rich for a reason because there's a nutrient balance that does need to be struck there. So that you have a viable ecosystem. In agriculture, when Bill talks about keeping water in place, that's exactly right. Slowing down the water, managing the water, managing the nutrients in that basin in agriculture is key. Right now, we did NRCS did a fascinating survey. They just put out here about a month ago that showed that 99% of the crop acres in the Western Lake Erie Basin already have at least one conservation practice on them. And almost 80% have more than two practices on them. Almost 60% right now are managed to control all phosphorus runoff. So it's at equilibrium with crop uptake.
There's kind of a constellation of practices that this involves.
Yes, there is. It's not one. It's not just one. One practice is going to solve everything. Interestingly, you didn't have this problem with the lake, with the algal blooms. At least we weren't looking for it, and it wasn't as prevalent, a decade ago.
Right.
And interestingly, we have more conservation going on right now in agriculture in that basin than we've ever had.
But so then it must have reached a tipping point.
Yeah.
It didn't matter anymore. Yeah, it was that legacy and the ongoing.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating question that we're actually working with Ohio State on and with USDA is what we're calling, it's called the edge of field studies. And what we're looking at is what has happened, what has changed, because we have what we call conservation no-till. So you're not disturbing the ground anymore, right? You're leaving it in place. Scientists telling us for decades that's a very good agricultural conservation practice, and it is. There's no doubt. But over time, is there other things you should do along with that in more detail and more prescription to make it work in the longer run? And that's what we're looking at right now, some terrific studies with OSU. And we're just now getting the data back. It's a six-year study. We're three-year in. And we're learning that, there's additional management things that you have to do, very prescriptive management things that you have to do on your farms now to continue to get that environmental benefit.
You know, one of the issues when we were talking about draining the Black Swamp, one of the ways they did that was with tiles, right? They had tiles
right.
that moved through, and that is a legacy issue.
Yes,
is it not,
is.
Bill Mitch? It's not. Is there a part? I mean, how far back does that go, and how big of a deal is that? Because that's what shooting the runoff straight out of the field.
Right. If you look up that part of the state, other than Bowling Green, which is a new city, all the cities up there were around the Black Swamp. They weren't in the Black Swamp. So it's basically mostly farmland. There's no big towns except for Bowling Green for some reason in the middle.
Yeah.
And that was where the Black Swamp was. Okay, tile drained completely. It's better drained than Columbus, Ohio, probably in that regard. And it's a question of resources, our ability, and I was glad to hear what Adam said about these exciting opportunities they're doing on the three farms out there. I'm very interested in learning more, Adam, actually. And I think that's part of the solution.
Is tile removal part of this, Adam Sharp?
I don't think it is, and here's why. Interestingly, this edge of field data that we're seeing does some phosphorus, and phosphorus being one of the major drivers here, right of these algal blooms. Does these tile systems, are they the main channel for phosphorus moving from the farm fields?
Uh-huh.
And it looks like the answer is maybe not, which I'll be honest with you is surprising. What we're seeing is one of the major drivers is when you have a no-till system, so you're not disturbing the ground,
right.
you're applying the fertilizer on the surface of the ground. And what's happening then is if you get these larger rain events with weather-changing patterns and larger rainfall events, is if you don't incorporate that fertilizer into the ground, that's where you're getting some of the major runoff.
It's just washing it away.
It's a quick, hard rain that might be unpredicted, right, or that you're not expecting to be so intense,
mm-hmm.
and it moves it off the surface. So at one point, just within even the last year, a lot of folks were looking at tile. Tile, certainly. We're looking at various new ways to filter water that comes out of tiles. We're looking at scrubbers. We're looking at various systems to be put in place to help manage what's coming out of the tile. But interestingly, it does look more like those surface conditions in incorporating fertilizer, making sure we have some practices and technologies to incorporate the fertilizer might actually be more beneficial.
Tell us more about some of the let's take a quick call here. Tiffany, you're on the air. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi. So I'm a student at OSU, and I actually study water quality. I've had the opportunity of getting to see Dr. Mitch speak a couple times, which was really exciting. And so one of the things that I think is most important about water quality is outreach and education about how important it is. And so I'm actually working on a project called Water Across the World right now, where we work with students in Ohio and Uganda, Africa, and teach them about how important wetlands and forests are for our water quality, and teach them about the biota and the water. So that's a really exciting project that I get to work on through OSU. And we actually have, if anybody is interested in learning about what we do, we have a page on buckeyefunder.osu.edu, and you go to the Water Across the World link, and you can take a look. So that's all I wanted to say.
All right, Tiffany. Okay. Thank you so much.
Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
I got your email. I can say a word about that because this is important. What we're talking about, this eutrophication of Lake Erie, eutrophication of the Everglades, destroying the estuaries in Florida, all of that is due to excessive nutrients, and it's not localized to America. There are, I think Jay Martin told me, there were 750 extreme cases of eutrophication around the world. Extreme. I would put Lake Erie in that category. I'd put Everglades is not there yet, by the way, but it will be. And it put that's a lot of, so it's a worldwide phenomenon, especially in the industrialized world. And it's beyond our capability maybe to solve it. Maybe the horse is out of the barn, but I think we need to try.
Yeah. Adam Sharp?
Yeah, I could mention a couple, Ann, you asked earlier about some of these practices.
Yeah.
And Bill mentioning, what are some of the solutions. Some of the solutions that we're doing right now in the Western Lake Erie Basin, two-stage ditch, the Nature Conservancy, working with one of our farms, Kurt Farms, they've put in place what we call a two-stage ditch. So instead of the traditional, if you will, straight waterway where nutrients are moving into that waterway, and it's moving rapidly. Instead, the two-stage ditch is a larger ditch, but it's got a smaller channel at the bottom that meanders. So it brings back in that more natural system for filtrating and slowing down water.
How much does it meander? What does it look like?
Yeah, well, so it looks like it looks like a large creek, if you will. Now it's dug out and developed, and then it's filter stripped. So there's grass on both sides of the upper parts of the ditch, but in the bottom you're putting in natural grasses. You're putting in aquatic grasses. So in the bottom is flat, and it might be anywhere from 3, 4, 5 feet across in the bottom, but that is meandering, and it's allowed to move in that channel, and maybe even in some of the larger parts, 10 feet, 12 feet across. So now you're allowing it to slow down and move back and forth more. It's interesting. We're actually going to put monitors on that two-stage ditch here, hopefully by the end of this year, and look at the water as it comes into it on one side, right, goes out on the other side, and then also monitoring the surface and the tile runoff into those ditches. So it's interesting.
Are these mostly evidence-based practices that you're talking about?
Yes.
There's been research done on the effectiveness of this.
Well, that's what we're in the process of literally doing right now.
Okay. Yeah, it's a proven technique.
It's ongoing.
I mean, Andy Ward here at Ohio State and Jennifer Tank at Notre Dame have both shown that these work. We just got to call them two-stage streams or something.
That's right. Two-stage streams.
Ditches.
Yes, that would make a difference.
We got to change that.
But they got the right idea. Basically, they're fluvial flowing wetlands.
Yeah.
So they are what I've been talking about for years.
And is the idea to keep them on a farm, to have them meandering through a farm instead of out of the farm?
Right. Well, they're through the fields.
Through the fields.
So
right.
It's where the natural waterways would be.
It's sort of a restoration of the ditch.
Okay, the natural ditch.
Almost like what they're doing with Kissimmee River in Florida, to put the wigwags back in the thing, give it a floodplain so that when the floods come, it can spread out. It's the same. It's on a small scale what they're doing on the Kissimmee River in Florida.
Is it expensive?
Yes, it is. And we appreciate it.
Is
in
it
our
because
CS.
It takes land from the fields or what?
Well, both, right?
Process of doing
so it is a larger system. And that's right. You're taking land out of production. So the farmer has to be able to make sure that's, one, affordable, and also you're going to do it, though, if it works. So you need to make sure you see the data and you understand how the system's going to work. But does it, right, it's a lot of work to put those in. We're looking at other ways, too. And one of the interesting pieces that's come along right now is the use of technology. I mentioned heavy rains and surface runoff. So in the agriculture world, one of the things we're doing is we developed an app for your mobile phone, and it is designed specifically for farmers to be able to both have their weather forecast, but it's GPS located right to the individual fields that they're applying their nutrients on. We passed two mandatory laws in Ohio that agriculture supported. One of those is requiring farmers to be certified to apply fertilizer. If you're applying on more than 50 acres, which is basically every farmer, you have to be certified to do so. And the second law is specifically aimed at the Western Lake Erie Basin. And it says you can't apply fertilizer on frozen or snow-covered ground or when the ground is saturated or potentially saturated.
How do you measure that?
So how do you figure out what potentially saturated,
right?
And when you're gonna, what you're gonna do? Well, you look at the weather forecast, and what we have is looking at NOAA data. We've now plugged in NOAA data straight into this app, and the farmers right on their phone when they pull up the app. It's called OnMark. It's free for farmers. We developed it so it is free. Soil and Water Conservation Service and our Knox County Farm Bureau. This is a grassroots effort. Put this thing together, and you pull it up, and it on each field, it's a record keeping system. So you can go in and plug that field. It'll tell you exactly what kind of rainfall is expected in the next 12 hours, 24 hours, and it'll give you either a green light, yep, you can apply fertilizer, or a red light, no, you cannot. And it's set up to actually coordinate directly with Ohio law that we now have that says you cannot apply fertilizer in certain conditions in the Western Lake Erie Basin. So it allows the farmer to be able to comply with the law and understand when they can and can't apply fertilizer, or if they do apply during that time frame, the practices they have to do in order to keep it in place, which typically means incorporation.
Like mitigating practice.
Yeah, like it chiseling it into the ground.
Gotcha.
Disking it into the ground or applying it into a cover crop.
How much, so if you can't apply it on frozen land, is that a common practice? Is that because it makes the crops better, or is that a way to dispose of?
It typically is not a common practice.
Okay.
But what you have happen, of course, is you can't predict the weather. So in agriculture, if you're a livestock farm and you're storing manure over the wintertime, when you have so much storage, you want to be able to keep that manure at your farm until the conditions are appropriate to spread. So one of the challenges is making sure farmers have enough storage to be able to keep the manure until the conditions are able to be spread. And as we know in Ohio, sometimes that might be mid-January. The weather might be beautiful and dry. Other times it might be March or April or the middle of August. You know, we don't know. So making sure farmers can manage the manure and the storage is a big part of that. And that's costly, right? Because that's a huge investment on the farm to make sure that you're able to control the manure until you can apply it at the right time. So typically, no. It's not a practice that's used commonly, but it does happen if you have a choice between having manure stored on the farm and you want to move it out to a field and the weather just isn't cooperating for weeks on end, which can happen in Ohio. What we have now in Ohio is a set of standards that if you can take that manure out of the farm and you can take it out to those fields, but then there's a very, even if it's under emergency conditions only, and you have to get permission to do this now in the Western Lake Erie Basin, but then you can apply that manure, but it has to have a series of setbacks and all kinds of restrictions.
The law, new law about when you can apply animal waste to the fields now, that this was the first winter that was in effect, right?
Yeah, about half. So okay. Depending on the size of your farm, the legislature set that up, so it depends on the size of your farm. If you were a larger farm, then yes, it was already applying. If you're a smaller farm, you have through next year to still be in compliance. So it was kind of a two-step implementation.
Okay. Yep. We are going to continue our conversation about how to protect our water and still grow the food we need to eat. With me here at the Ohio State University Chadwick Arboretum annual plant sale on the OSU campus, Adam Sharp. You just heard from him. He's Vice President of Public Policy at the Ohio Farm Bureau. Also with us, Professor William Mitch. He's Director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and Founding Director of the Wilma H. Schiermeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at OSU. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is a special broadcast from OSU's Chadwick Arboretum Spring Plant Sale on the OSU campus. For more information, go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Ohio's most precious natural resource is its water. Its third biggest industry is agriculture. According to PolitiFact, it contributed $105 billion to Ohio's total economic output of almost $900 billion in 2010, an 11.7% share. Ohio's food and agricultural cluster accounts for 14% of Ohio jobs and saw a 1% increase in job growth just from 2008 to 2010. But there has been a price to pay. Phosphorus runoff from fertilizers that fed harmful algal blooms in Lake Erie 2 years ago. Toledo's entire water supply was turned off for 3 days because of the contamination. Still with us is Bill Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder of the Wilma H. Schiermeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park here at Ohio State. And Bill, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
Also with us is Vice President of Public Policy at the Ohio Farm Bureau, Adam Sharp. And thanks to you as Adam.
Yes, thank you for being here.
A recent report from the University of Michigan and Ohio states that changing fertilizing practices on half the crops in the Maumee River watershed could significantly reduce phosphorus runoff. And you're talking about some of the ways to do that on these three test farms. They're going to be sort of a show and tell for farmers across the region. In coming years, what can you talk a little bit, Adam Sharp, about what the buy-in is on the part of farmers? Sometimes,
yeah.
It's depicted or felt like it's a It's a battle going on.
Yeah, well, actually, I think it's exciting. And in fact, in Ohio here, like I mentioned, we've been invited to speak, and we got one of our farmers from the Western Lake Erie Basin testifying before the U.S. Congress, the Agriculture Committee on conservation success stories, and highlighting actually what we're doing here in Ohio here in a couple weeks. And it's because of these very proactive steps that we are taking. One of the first things we did before Toledo, several years before Toledo, was we put a letter out, Ohio Farm Bureau, as well as all the Ohio agriculture groups, OSU and others signed on to this letter. And we said, we expect every farmer to do their part and to provide by what we call the four R's, which is applying the right rate of fertilizer at the right time, at the right place, and the right type of fertilizer. So four R's is what we call it. And this has been a heavily promoted practice. Soil test, understand what your soil levels are of your nutrients. Then apply what's needed for the crop to uptake, not more. If you have too much phosphorus already, then draw it down using crops. Variable rate fertilizer application is something that's become proactive, but also very popular in Ohio. And this says that when you're using the newer technology, newer fertilizer applicators, as you move across the field, GPS signals will tell you, as you've done your soil tests, where to apply fertilizer, and then the system shuts off when you get to areas where you have too much phosphorus already or already enough phosphorus or nutrients in the ground. So these types of variable rate fertilizer application have become very popular.
Sounds widely used, though.
It is, but it's affordable. Variable rate fertilizer application, we use it on our farm just south here, just south of Columbus. But we're a very average family farm size of 500 acres. Farmers of all scale are using variable rate fertilizer technology right now, which has led to a trend. And for the last almost 8 years, I believe now, OSU data will show that we're in a deficit application, if you will, of phosphorus now in Ohio. So, in fact, we're actually applying less now phosphorus than crops are uptaking. So we're on the right trajectory toward managing our phosphorus. And we're doing that because farmers are stepping in and doing their part.
Hey, Bill Mitch, how much, we have an email from JT, and maybe you can address this. Can you have your guest talk about the effect of lawn fertilizer runoff? It's not just agriculture per se.
Well, that's always brought up in these kind of cases, and I have to give a little history of an experience that suggests that, at least for the Gulf of Mexico, there was the will 20 years ago to solve the problem, and we haven't done it. 20 years ago, I was asked by the federal government to solve the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia. We put a committee together, and we gave recommendations. A very strong emphasis in that report, not surprisingly, was that we had to restore some of our landscape to wetlands and bottomland forest to absorb the phosphorus. In that case, it was nitrogen, more importantly, but to absorb the nutrients that were coming off the farm fields. And that was 20 years ago. And I'm probably the only person that's been following this hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico every year since then. And the government said it should be 5,000 square kilometers, which is the size of New Jersey. Or no, that's the size of a smaller state. It's now currently the size of the state of New Jersey. It's averaging 15,000 square kilometers. So they have not solved that problem in 20 years, despite you're probably too young to remember when we were dealing with hypoxia.
I've been working on hypoxia issues in Washington, D.C. I was working for the U.S. EPA.
So you understand.
I'm very familiar with
you. You understand that issue.
Yes, I am.
And that, so that's still persistent. It's still going on. We didn't solve the problem. I still get on my every talk I give, I say, look, we've got to solve this problem. So it's nitrogen going down the Gulf of Mexico, phosphorus going to the Lake Erie. We've got both problems that we've got to solve in Ohio and the Midwest. So, again, I think what's underplayed here is the idea that some of our landscape, it may be 10%, it may be 20%, has to go back to ecosystems that provide ecosystem services.
The natural way to solve the problem,
and it doesn't cost you anything. It does cost you the loss of land for production, but there's even a way around that, if I had time to talk about. But we have 20 years of experience at the Olentangy River wetlands. They take out phosphorus, they take out nitrogen, both. We have gigantic experience in Florida Everglades. They built 60,000 acres of treatment wetlands. They're not allowed to call them wetlands. They have to call them STAs because their lawyers told them they couldn't call them wetlands. That's another story. But they are wetlands, absolutely, right? You've seen them, Adam.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely wetlands. And they are incredible. They're stripping the phosphorus out, and some of them have been working for 20 or 30 years. So I'm saying that has to be on the plate of possibilities, land uses in this in the Black Swamp area, especially because it used to be the Black Swamp. And so this is where the idea of restoring parts of the Black Swamp, which there's only tiny remnants. There's a little place called Gall Woods that's up near Toledo, and then there's one other location, and that's it.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore, but bringing back some of that wetland offers the ability to have a natural sink on the landscape. Let's face it, if we're putting fertilizer on the land, it shouldn't go off the land.
Okay.
Period.
Adam Sharp, I mean, is that part of some
yes,
of these
it is part
demonstration
of the,
farms?
It is. Wetlands Reserve Program through USDA is a very popular program. And this is a program that allows farmers to take land out of production and build back wetlands. And in fact, we have a lot of that going on in Ohio and in the Western Lake Erie Basin. It's a voluntary program. There's a series of these types of programs, though, that are built and designed for working land. So keep growing production, you know, keep agricultural production on the ground.
Which is what Bill was saying. You can have a farm and do this,
There's
too.
A number of things you can do and work with conservation to have that success. It's very costly, though. It is very costly, to restore wetlands and do these types of work that we talked about earlier on streams. One of the things that we heard, this was one of the big questions we heard constantly when we put together a large coalition of folks, more than just agriculture. So agriculture, environmental groups, the wastewater treatment folks, tourism from Lake Erie, Lake Erie Shores and Islands were part of our group, part of our coalition, Ohio State. And we asked people what were some of the most important issues that we need to address in Ohio around water quality. And, of course, the biggest thing that kept coming up was we see a bunch of good ideas and things we can do to help fix this problem, but we don't have the money to do it. So we came up with the idea of what we're calling the Ohio Water Trust that we're advocating for right now. And this is a bonding measure that would help us pay for not just agriculture. Agriculture would be one part of it, but also restoring these natural systems that Bill talks about as well. And the fund could then also be used for the infrastructure systems for our urban landscapes, for our sewage and septic problems that we have. And we have a fair amount of those challenges
right.
as well. So it would be used threefold here in Ohio because that is a big challenge, right? The funding. And so we think we actually have a decent solution for that.
And there's one other thing I want to add to that funding. You probably know about it, Adam, but maybe the public doesn't. You build a wetland, it takes phosphorus and nitrogen out, but it also takes carbon. It sequesters it in the soil forever. And carbon is now a monetary unit in the rest of the world. You can get money for taking carbon out of the atmosphere. So that's a whole new economy that's coming along line that I think would be a payoff for someone who converts the land to it could be, first of all, they could get paid for taking the nitrogen and phosphorus out, but secondarily, they could get into the carbon economy, we call it now, where eventually
credits
a pound
for
of
that.
Carbon will be worth so many dollars. That's absolutely going to happen now with our climate change philosophy, I think. So there's some exciting new ideas coming along that make it. That's why my talk that I gave yesterday at OESU Manion, Madison, was phosphorus and nitrogen and carbon. Oh, my.
Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. I know that manure is an issue. I was wondering if livestock farmers typically compost their manure. I would also like to comment that the restoration of natural environments around fields helps bees, and bees help farmers, too.
Okay, good point. Okay. We talk about that a lot. Adam Sharp?
Yeah, great question. With manure management, absolutely. We have farmers in the Western Lake Erie Basin and across the state building various types of using various types of technology, composting. When you look at more, manure's different for each different type of livestock. So if you're talking about poultry, it's a drier manure, and you can more store that into a drier condition and compost it and bag it and move it easier. When you talk about dairy manure has more liquid involved in it, so you have to treat it and deal with it in a different way. And we're building anaerobic digesters, which breaks down that manure and composts it to a degree. And what it's doing is taking out the liquid, so that you can reutilize the liquid, the water, and then you can take that that more concentrated nutrient and you can move it further. You can move it away from where you've been currently applying it, so you can move it to where it's needed and reutilize. Because, again, it's a resource. We talk about nutrients, so we got to be careful to remember that N, P, and K are terrific things. It's what we grow our food with, and it's what we grow our plants with, sitting here at the plant sale. So N, P, and K is very important, and it's making sure we move the nutrients from where they're maybe concentrated to where we can better utilize them.
Well, Adam Sharp, I want to thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it, as always.
Thank you.
Adam Sharp, he's Vice President of Public Policy at the Ohio Farm Bureau. Also, Bill Mitch, thanks as always for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Glad to come in.
That's Professor William Mitch. He's Director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and Founding Director of the Wilma H. Schiermeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University. We are on the campus of OSU right now at the Chadwick Arboretum Annual Plant Sale, the corner of Lane Avenue and Fred Taylor Drive. Check it out. Go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.